I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas City, Missouri's Port Authority has broad power, but none of its board members are elected. Today, a closer look at one of the most powerful agencies in the city. While many residents and Mayor Quinton Lucas want tax breaks to developers cut, Port KC has been approving them. We'll find out how the agency can act so independently and just how far its powers reach. Then, the effects of this year's record rainfalls are still being felt by farmers in Northwest Missouri. We'll talk with one man who saw more than just his fields go underwater and learn from a soil expert what it'll take to get flooded acres ready for planting. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Quick now, name the Kansas City governmental body that can offer tax breaks, borrow money, condemn property, and set up taxing districts. And it's not the City Council. Most Kansas Citians would struggle to name this agency. It's the Kansas City Port Authority, and critics say it threatens to undermine new Mayor Quinton Lucas's pledge to rein in tax breaks for developers. Just a few weeks ago, the Port Authority approved the issuance of up to $25 billion in bonds for a new data center in the city. That apparently didn't sit well with the new mayor. Tensions between mayors and the Port Authority aren't new. Sly James had his share. Now a conversation with a man who can shed light on this from the Port Authority's vantage point. That's the president and CEO of the authority, John Stevens. John, good morning. Nice to have you again.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you.
How can it be that an agency that can do all that yours can operate so largely under the radar screen?
Well, you know, I think somewhat it's in how it was created and the fact that it is a political subdivision of the state of Missouri by Chapter 68 of state legislative code. And there are 15 port authorities throughout the state. And over the years, I think that has led to a lot of misunderstandings, a lot of sort of confusion as to what it is. But I'm here to be very, very clear that Port KC is a Kansas City. We are here focused on Kansas City economic development, Kansas City transportation, and jobs and affordable housing for Kansas Citians.
Because one of your board members just last week made a point of saying that he thought the Port Authority reported to state government, to the governor.
Yeah. And, you know, I think to be very clear, the mayors of Kansas City, Missouri appoint the commissioners that I report to, that I was hired by. And I think I would say very clearly over the years, I think the organization has flown under the radar. I've been in this role for 10 months. I've worked very, very closely with the commissioners. I've worked very closely with the now mayor, with many of the council members. And I can tell you, I think that there's a lot more focus on making sure that we clearly articulate the advantages and benefits of Port KC and what we do collaboratively and in partnership with the community.
I was going to say, doesn't a sense of what Port KC does, John, need to change? Because whenever you have an agency out there that people don't really fully understand, don't know fully what they're doing out there, that tends to raise suspicions and raise all manner of questions.
Certainly, without a doubt. And I don't want to speak on behalf of my commissioners, but I will tell you, I think that's one of the key reasons that they brought me in. I think it's one of the reasons I can tell you that our team, our staff, and the commissioners are committed to good work, quality work, transparent work. It is a public entity. But I think we need to do more about spreading the word and having discussions and being at more tables as we work through a lot of these things.
Are the other 14 port authorities around Missouri, are they all as active as Port KC is?
No, they're all over the board. You know, a lot of them have done big industrial projects. They've taken on various projects. But I would say, given the fact that we've remediated and redeveloped 55 acres of the riverfront, we operate Berkeley Riverfront Park, we operate a large port terminal, which many people don't even know, 100,000 plus tons of goods transited through the West Bottoms. We're developing 420-acre intermodal hub in the Blue River Corridor. We operate Richards Gebauer, the former air base. It's now a commerce center.
Right.
So we have large industrial distribution facilities, but then we also are tasked with redeveloping the riverfront. And I think most people would say that's decades overdue, and we need to do that.
Maybe one of the issues here is that you're called Port KC, and KC doesn't have a lot of ports, John.
Right.
Oceans that I've seen lately.
No oceans, but...
I wish, but yeah. Not today.
You know, the Missouri River transits tons of goods and is very valuable. And I can tell you, when the port shut down in 2014, or was shut down until 2015, there really wasn't any transit there. We invested millions of dollars, and it's probably a good time to add that, yes, we do exemption. We have exemption authority, condemnation authority, a lot of these things that you said, but we use them really almost exclusively for the focus of quality job development, transportation, logistics, and the money goes back into that because we are not allocated state tax dollars, occasionally grants, federal grants, Corps of Engineers grants, but very seldom. We really are a enterprise organization that generates its own revenue for reinvestment.
Well, let's be crystal clear then. Are you guys accountable to?
Well, we are accountable to fundamentally the state legislature and the governor of the state of Missouri.
Are they paying any attention?
The governor just came in for 2 hours last week and had a large conversation. We're very engaged
with Port KC.
He was in our offices discussing the benefits of logistics and transportation and where we need to look for jobs and quality jobs and trade jobs, particularly well-paying $15 an hour wage jobs, and how we can be a creative catalyst to bring and secure more of those jobs for Kansas City, Missouri.
So how much influence does the mayor and the city council have then? You report to the governor and the legislature. What about the city?
Well, from a very tactical standpoint, of course, they have incredible power. The mayor makes appointments to the Port KC Commission. I meet with the mayor regularly, feel we have a great relationship, meet with council members regularly. We have a lot of collaborative discussions on a lot of projects. And I would say, again, not to talk about me, but in how I believe we should be guiding this organization for the future. Anyone who knows me in Kansas City over the last 15 or 20 years knows that I'm very open, very engaged in the community, and our organization and our entire team stand ready to be that way across the board.
I was going to say, what is your relationship with the new mayor? There's been reports in the newspaper, on this radio station, about some tensions between Port KC and the new mayor. Where does it stand today?
I feel I have a very good relationship with the mayor. I feel Port KC has a good relationship with the mayor. I think, like most things, there is a very successful council member that moved into the mayor's seat and has a lot on his plate, and we're working to make sure that he understands what we do, that I understand his goals and objectives on behalf of himself as mayor and the council, and that we can look to align those goals. He said himself in his opening editorial statement about we need collaboration and creative solutions from organizations like Port KC.
Yeah.
I can tell you creative solutions are what we really want to bring to bear. And one of the discussions we had, not to give a an annoying water-based pun, but we really do believe in moving in the same direction downstream on a lot of these shared goals, because I think we all share the issues of workforce housing, affordable housing, quality job development, redevelopment of neighborhoods that are struggling because they have not had reinvestment. And we have to do that in a holistic way while still redeveloping some of the areas that maybe are fragile, like the riverfront.
John Stevens, the president and CEO of the Port KC, Port Authority KC, is my guest. Well, let's turn to the nut of the issue here. Just a few weeks ago, Port KC took some action on approving the issuance of up to $25 billion in bonds for a data center that may come to Kansas City for Google that would create just a handful of jobs, but the cost of the infrastructure is enormous. That didn't sit well with a mayor who wants to crack down on developer incentives. So how do you square that nut?
Yeah. Well, I think we have to take a step back and say that data centers, whether you believe in their economic benefit or not, the state of Missouri has tried for many, many years to attract large-scale data centers.
And has struggled.
And they have not changed. They've not aligned state laws and state tax structure to do that. So over many, many months, the state economic development department, local development leaders on both sides of the state line, KCADC and others, really looked at this and determined that this was going to be a valuable first step if Kansas City, Missouri were to be able to land a data center of this size.
It's valuable. Why? Because, again, the criticism here, John, as you well know, is that you create a couple dozen jobs in exchange for, it's true, you know, tens of millions of dollars in infrastructure construction. But what does the city get out of it if there's no local taxing units like the library and the school district don't benefit?
Sure. Well, first, the school districts in North Kansas City will benefit greatly through payment in lieu of taxes, pilot payments over years.
And that has to be negotiated, though, right?
That will be negotiated, but should Google and any other data centers, I'll speak hypothetically since they haven't made this final commitment yet. But some of the benefits of data centers, there's a reason Nebraska, Iowa, Ohio have so aggressively gone after data centers. And there's a number of reasons. One is you have the energy taxes, the energy assessments, energy taxes, those are tens of millions of dollars. Then when you're going into
because they use a lot of energy,
they use a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And so they pay all of those taxes. They pay other pilot payment taxes. They pay to the school districts. But then also there's a lot of contract laborers that are beyond the guaranteed minimums. And then, again, speaking across the board of data centers in general, many of these data centers, as we all know, every time we pick up our phones, data is not decreasing. There's not less data in the world on a daily basis. So what we have seen when we looked into this is many data centers around the country will build phase one, building one, and then they have brought together highly skilled, highly paid contractors, craftspeople, electricians, to the tune of sometimes hundreds to even 1,200, 1,300, 1,500 people. And they stay mobilized for sometimes 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 years on site.
But the optics here are rough. Here we are giving tax breaks to one of the world's richest corporations again at a time when we just had an election in this city in which we elected a mayor who ran on a platform of saying, the time has come to stop doing exactly that. That's the rub here, isn't it?
Well, it certainly is a rub. And I do understand, but I do believe that a project like this data center, much like a manufacturing project, you know, states, including Missouri, have incredible tax benefits at a state level to large manufacturing, to recruit large manufacturers. The data center doesn't do that. Port KC was able to provide that sort of in somewhat in collaboration with the state's desire to attract a data center. And so while the optics may be, I understand why people say that, but I will also say that when you look, if you break it down from an economic standpoint, data centers don't have to locate in any specific geography. They don't have to locate, they don't say, well, my customers are coming from this location. They can be anywhere in the country. So we do believe that a net benefit of this in order to show that Missouri and that Kansas City, Missouri is open to tech development, tech growth, tech investment, and tech jobs for the future is valuable.
We're talking with the president and CEO of the Port Authority of Kansas City. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Jim from Midtown. Jim, you're on Up to Date with John Stevens. Good morning.
Thank you. How does the Port Authority justify granting incentives to a building on the plaza to a firm that abandoned an incented building in the river market, specifically the Board of Trade? How do you justify that?
Well, I believe you're speaking to the Board of Trade building and the Populous deal. That was before I joined Port KC, so I can only speculate as to all of the historical decisions there. But I will say that was probably a different time and consideration. We didn't have a border war truce, of which Port KC has been out front in saying that we are not just aggressively in support of this, but we are aligning all of our support to do that. And two, those were high-paying jobs that I think many in Kansas City, Missouri, beyond just Port Authority, but also the city council and the mayor at the time and a lot of other city leaders wanted to retain those jobs and that headquarters in Kansas City, Missouri.
How many of those jobs are with people that actually live in Kansas City, Missouri?
I do not know that, sir.
Isn't that an important consideration?
It would be, yes.
Jim, he's saying he wasn't in charge when that decision was made.
Well, how do you justify incenting an office building at 12th and Main adjacent to the streetcar line?
Well, there are many factors, and that is one that is just being considered. There is nothing that has been, or are you talking, okay, you're talking about the City Center Square, now Lightwell Project. That's because that is a 1970s building that had been incredibly laggard, had been much lower in its lease rates and lease obligations. It was leasing, I believe, at 40% occupancy. And we believe that a limited exemption incentive to bring that back, to compel tens of millions of private dollars to bring that back to full Class A stature, will recruit and retain jobs downtown that are very, very needed to keep downtown Kansas City thriving.
Jim, thank you for your call. Maybe one issue for a lot of folks might simply be this, John. Here is the Port Authority cutting deals, offering incentives in places far beyond the ports of Kansas City. You're doing this all over the city, and that might cause a lot of people to scratch their heads and think, isn't that the city council's job? What are you guys doing, roaming so far away from the riverfront?
Yeah. Well, and I think that is, and you alluded to it, Steve, that the name Port KC sort of implies a lot of things.
Yes, it does.
And I will say the majority of the projects, the majority of the investment and reinvestment, anybody who visits Berkeley Park sees what's going on down there with Barquet, everywhere, what happens in the Blue River Corridor and what happens in our inland ports, sees the value of Port KC directly related to that.
Our caller just was talking about the Plaza and 12th and Main. That's not near water.
No, but those are part of a larger, because another thing that I think we need to do a better job of explaining is the port district, as created by the state of Missouri, is the city limits, municipal boundaries of Kansas City, Missouri.
When were you guys created? When did you come into being?
Created in 1977 and really kind of became active in remediating brownfields and bringing back and reinvesting in development really in the 90s primarily.
Again, you're created as a result of state legislation that gave you this far-roaming portfolio, if you will.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
You know, Dave Helling, my former colleague from the Star on the editorial board, just took a bite out of your backside. He called for Mayor Lucas to ask every current Port KC board member to resign. Then, Dave wrote, he can appoint new members more sympathetic to the voters' concerns about overuse of incentives. What did you think of that?
Well, first, he also went on to say that there's no barges and transportation on the in Kansas City doesn't have a port, but that's beside the point. I understand the sentiment from his op-ed. I do. And I think it just doubles down. That has nothing to do with a relationship with the mayor. It has nothing to do with a relationship with the city council. To me, what it has to do is it shows the work that we have ahead to make sure that we're showing what kind of partnership and what kind of partner we are in the community to the benefit of development in Kansas City.
In your discussions with the mayor, has he indicated he's going to ask for the resignations of members of your board?
He has not. We have not directly discussed that, and I haven't asked that.
Anticipate it? Sly James, Quentin Lucas's predecessor, did something very similar not long after he took office.
It would certainly be within his authority and purview to request that. I could tell you that we are focused on explaining how we can collaborate, how we can work together. Just last week, we announced another new affordable housing project on the riverfront, workforce quality housing. We are much more committed in working together and showing what we have to do and what we can do hand in hand versus in any sort of adversarial relationship, be it real or contrived.
You're saying you want to be an asset to the city in all ways, even when it comes to what can you do when it comes to affordable housing, John, and some of the issues that are so high on Mayor Lucas's agenda here?
Well, certainly you open this episode with some of the powers we have, and I don't look at them as powers. I look at them as opportunities of what we can do. We have great relationships with a lot of people in development, particularly ones that are working on transit-oriented development, on workforce and affordable housing, and then we coalesce because one of our key bases, I mean, what we're really founded in, is creating quality jobs and quality opportunities and retaining and growing jobs in Kansas City. And if you don't have quality places for those citizens to live, we are not going to be able to recruit and retain growth. We've seen that in other cities that have, quote unquote, been successful, but they've left a large percentage of their citizens behind.
John, has the Port Authority become sort of a backdoor way for this city to approve tax incentives when the incentives are too hot politically for the city council to take on?
I would say that that certainly is not something that I would consider. I view everything pro facie on exactly what is the net benefit. And I can tell you that we're working very hard on our social equity, how we roll out to communicate exactly what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, and how we're going to communicate it to the citizens and their elected officials.
Mike from Kansas City, Missouri. Mike, you're on with John Stevens of Port Authority KC. Nice to have you.
Good morning. In a very desirable location like the Crossroads, why would consideration be given to an office building for a law firm right on the streetcar?
Well,
what's Mike referring
sure.
to, John?
He's referring to a project that was proposed. It has been held. It has not been advanced. And we're currently it's not on docket for consideration. But I will tell you from a Port KC perspective, we will consider and evaluate projects. And as far as retaining and growing jobs, even in areas like the Crossroads, there are certain considerations as to what level of exemption, if any, you provide, but at a low level of exemption, a low level of financial support in order to fill parking lots and infill derelict areas, even in areas like the Crossroads, there's still work to do. But I can tell you on that project, that one has been held and is not at this point, there is no step to move that project forward, which shows, again, that there is real and meaningful consideration of how these projects are evaluated.
Okay, that's John Stevens, the president and CEO of the KC Port Authority. John, thanks for coming in and answering my questions. I sure appreciate
it. Thanks, Steve. Anytime. I appreciate the opportunity.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Richard Oswald, a farmer on the Kansas side who's been dealing with all manner of struggles in the wake of all the flooding this year on his 2,000 acres of property. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. Today, my weekly newsletter could be landing in your inbox. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske to get exclusive insights from me and program highlights from the up-to-date team. Go to kcur.org/Kraske to subscribe. Tuesday on the program, a fortune built from producing ethanol, military gear, and more, how Koch Industries grew to be one of the most influential businesses and political influences in America. Well, Richard Oswald knows something about floods. He's lived through a bunch of them. In 1993, 2011, 2019, even the monster flooding of 1952 when he was a little boy. Even today, Oswald is unable to plant 3/4 of his 2,000-acre farm. Those acres are still underwater or impossible to plant. To compound his woes, his home where he's lived since birth has been destroyed by the water, roads are still washed out, and help from the federal government has been slow to arrive. We'll talk to the lifelong farmer and later to a soil expert who will detail the science behind what flooding does to the soil. Richard Oswald is a fifth-generation farmer in Atchison County on the Missouri side of the state line, not the Kansas side. Richard, welcome. Nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks. My pleasure. I appreciate you giving me a chance to talk about this.
You know, I think a lot of our listeners, Richard, may be surprised to hear that your farm is still underwater. They think of flooding as something that happens in the springtime. Describe what it looks like today.
Well, today, I'm happy to say it's looking better. They've made significant progress in patching one of the two main breaks in our levee, and that's levee L550. We're clear up in the extreme northwest corner of Missouri. And the water is finally, the last couple of days, the water has finally started to slow down, and I'm seeing a little bit more in the way of dry areas sticking up out of the water.
The land is drier, but there's still, if I understand right, Richard, a whole lot of sand in your fields. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's sand, a lot of sand, especially near the levee breaks, and when you get close to them, to the main levee break, which is right near the mouth of the Nishnabotna River, which comes into Missouri out of Iowa. And where it enters the Missouri River, There was a center pivot not too far from the break in the levee, and it literally knocked that center pivot down and buried it in sand. And then the sand deposits are a little difficult to predict where they might pop up. Generally, if there's a kind of a torrent of water, like where it overflows Highway 136, then when that water comes across a barrier and starts to slow down, it'll make a pile of sand, and those piles of sand they've been compared to sand dunes, but they can be 6 to 8 feet tall, and anything over about a foot of sand on typical good farmland makes it almost impossible to farm again without doing something to mitigate that, either remove the sand or mix it in with the soil so that it's not so concentrated.
You know, Richard, excuse a question on behalf of a whole bunch of city dwellers out that are listening to this show. Why is there so much sand being deposited on your fields?
Well, sand is a major component of subsoil. Across most of the river valley, why there's deep deposits of sand down deep beneath the soil. And the river channel, like here in near Rockport, the river channel is about 18 feet deep. And so basically it's cut down to sand when it's in normal stage. Hmm. But when this flood occurred initially in March, the river went from its normal depth of about 18 to 20 feet at Brownville, Nebraska, which is just across the river from here. That's where the gauge is. It went to almost 46 feet. Hmm. And so all that water churning and flowing down through here stirs all that sand up and carries it along with it for as long as it goes. And each time it blows out of the levee, it carves a hole maybe 60 to 70 feet deep. That's one reason why it's taken a while to get the levees repaired, is because the hole that it made is so deep, and it goes clear down in there into the ground where those sand deposits are and just literally blows them out of there, and the sand flows with the water until the water slows and the sand can settle out.
You know, losing a season like this, Richard, what does that mean for you? How do you weather something like that?
I'll tell you, it's hard. This year especially was difficult because we had about 3 days warning. When Spencer Dam broke, it took about 3 days for that water to get here from Spencer Dam, and we had a little time as the water overflowed the levees. But because of the type of winter we'd had, it's been so wet and such an awful winter, and the levees were still muddy and they were no longer frozen, and so they just sort of dissolved. And when we were trying to move things, the rural roads were in such bad shape that we couldn't get big heavy trucks down to the farm, to the bins, to get the grain out of the bins and move that out of harm's way. And so here in northwestern Missouri and all up and down western Iowa, there's a huge amount of grain that's been lost.
So the result for you is that 1,500 of your 2,000 acres have been simply, what, they're underwater and unworkable this year. Do I have that right?
That's right, yeah. And up until just late this week, that water has continued to flow over most of those 1,500 acres. And even if there wasn't water on it, the remainder of it was so muddy you couldn't even access the land.
Hmm. What's your sense of what kind of toll all this flooding has had on farmers in your area? Not just loss of acres and loss of a season, but even psychological, Richard.
Well, it's difficult. It's a burden. And people my age, I'm almost 70 years old, and so everyone here who farms who's my age or older has experienced these river floods. And, you know, after 2011, we thought that was the worst that we'd ever see, because 2011 was just an unending, relentless flood that the Corps of Engineers sort of engineered, so that some areas flooded and some didn't. But our area was severely impacted, and that was difficult. And then to have this flood follow on the heels of that flood in less than 10 years, you know, I never thought I'd think about retirement, but today I think sometimes that looks pretty good.
Hmm. Just to cut to the quick here, you've said that suicide has been a very serious issue for farmers up in your area. I gather it's easy for you to understand why that is.
Well, I think that's, yeah, the the fear of suicides and has occupied the minds of a lot of farm organizations, because this is depressing, obviously, and we've seen a lot of depression clear across the farm sector the last few years because of the dairy situation and profitability in just about every sector of farming, and the pressure from debt and low markets. And so a lot of the farm organizations, like my farm organization, National Farmers Union, have dedicated a lot of energy and a lot of resources toward outreach and offering as much aid as they can to farmers and talking to them and really talking up this issue, also to make local healthcare professionals aware of the danger of this kind of an event and the toll that it takes on people.
What kind of toll has it taken on you?
Well, I like to think I'm a pretty tough guy, you know, mm-hmm. but it's still, I find it when I'm able to make it down to my home in the past, and I've gone down there, I've gone down in an airboat, and I've taken a big four-wheel drive tractor down there and driven through deep water with that to get down there and just, I don't know, look at things. And so you try to get down there and check things, because it's hard to be away from a place where, you know, I lived there my entire life. And I go down and I find it, I just find myself walking around looking at it, and I'm just dumbfounded. And any plans that I had of what I was going to do when I got there just leave my head. And then I leave, and then I ask myself, after I have an hour or two to think about it when I'm away from it, you know, why didn't I do this and why didn't I do that? And I hate to admit it, but I'd like to think I'm stronger than that, but it's hard.
How high did the water get next to your house?
Well, this flood, my house was has always been about 8 inches above the flood. In 1952, 1993 and 2011, it was about 8 inches above the flood, the ground floor, which I know that sounds close, but
I was going to say
it was always a reliable 8 inches. And this time we had about another 2 feet. So I had well over a foot of water in my house, which doesn't sound like much, but, you know, it's been sitting there like that since late March. And there's no way the water was flowing over the roads at one point, you know, of course, early in the flood, it was too deep and there was nothing to be done down there, and the water was around it. And I don't think it's going to be salvageable simply because of the mold and
right.
the decay that's taken place all these months. It's been a long time. And you talk about rebuilding a house that's probably valued maybe at $50,000 or $60,000 for the real property value here
right.
on the river bottom. It's an old house. It's 80 years old. But I just don't think that it's going to be worth the cost that it would take to restore it. Plus, you have to remember, you know, in 2011 we thought we'd never have a flood like this again, and then in 2019 we had a flood that was even deeper. So
yeah.
I have neighbors who built their houses up and were told, you know, if you build your house up to this height, it'll be safe, but it got wet again anyway this time.
So where have you been staying?
Well, I'm engaged. I was divorced several years ago, and since then I've become engaged. My fiance and I want to get married, but I told her, you know, I'm not going to move you into this house on the farm because you've never experienced a flood, and she has a lot of nice things, and she loves her things. I said, I'm not going to put you through that. I'm not going to put me through it either. So we decided to build a house on the bluff overlooking the river valley where we could see my home. And we started that last year, but because the weather was so awful last fall and over the winter, why the house wasn't done in time for this flood. So I stayed with family for a while, and then finally the house that she and I built was finished, and so now I'm living in it.
You know, what do you say to people, Richard, who point out that, you know, this is what you get for living in a floodplain?
Well, this is what I get for living in an area where they built levees and dams to protect us from flood, and we were not considered in a floodplain. FEMA didn't, you know, a lot of the rules said that this area was not endangered because we were protected by a federal levee.
Right.
This is what I get for people not realizing that when you build levees and dams for flood control, that needs to be the number one priority. And our levees and dams are infrastructure, and they are decaying infrastructure because the areas between the levees are silting full so that they don't have the space to contain the water. And those reservoirs up north in the Dakotas, those are silting full too. And there's no acknowledgement on the part of government or on the part of a lot of leaders that when you have that kind of a situation with aging infrastructure, plus you have rainfall that was typically around here 40 inches for 12 months, we're over 40 inches now, and it's just August. You can't manage a system like that for a spring rise and an autumn fall and all those other things that a lot of environmentalists want. When you have that much water coming through the system, it destroys what the environmentalists want, and it destroys everything that I want as well.
Yeah. Richard Oswald is a farmer, a fifth-generation farmer in Atchison County on the Missouri side of the state line. Richard, if you would, hang on with us for a few minutes. I want to bring in another guest here to talk about the impact of flooding on the soil. That's Deanne Presley. She's a professor in environmental soil science in the Department of Agronomy at Kansas State University. Professor, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, tell us about the sand. You know, I've seen photos of what flooding brings with it, and it's all this sand. I think for us city dwellers, it's hard to understand, just as Richard was describing to us, just how much sand we're talking about here.
Oh, yes. It can be very thick. I've seen both. There's two options. One is that you end up with land that gets scoured away, just literally carved away, so that can create craters or holes in fields. But then also the flip side is the deposits of sand. So they can be a few inches to a few feet thick, and they can really cause problems. They can take a normally productive field and create just these sand dunes where nothing will grow because just of lack of water.
When you say sand dunes, you mean sand piled how high?
Oh, well, in the Kansas River Valley, closer to me by Manhattan, we can see it about 1 to 2 feet thick.
So can farmers return to their fields once the water is gone, or is there just too much sand now for these farmers to manage?
Well, so in the floodplain around, again, between Manhattan and Topeka, let's say, there are highly variable soil types. So you can take a look at a field, look across it, and have an extreme variability in soil types. So you can have sandier in some places and then silty, and then it can be even clayey in some areas closer to, like, the bottoms of the hills. But when you get these new deposits of sand, I always say that roots hate layers and water hates layers. So as soon as you put a new layer of sand where there's been no soil development, no time for soil to develop, the horizons develop, it's just pure sand. It's just, imagine going and trying to plant some seeds into the sandbox in your yard. Though they might grow, you know, your sandbox probably grows a few weeds. They might grow, but they usually can't reach productivity. They can't get to the point where grain will fill and fill out the plant. So those, something's going to have to be done with those sand deposits.
You know, I've read that farmers were unable to plant more than 19 million acres in crops this year. That's the most unplanted acres since the USDA began reporting those figures back in 2007. Is flooding the main cause of that?
It's going to vary, sometimes flooding and sometimes drought, but those are going to be the two main reasons for prevented plant acres is flooding and drought, yeah. But flooding is usually the one to stop the planting in the spring.
So Richard was sort of talking about, you know, at what point can you begin to grow again when you mix the sand in with the soil? How much sand can there be for that to be overcome?
He said earlier 12 inches, so about a foot of sand is about as much as you could possibly. And I would say even sometimes just even 6 inches can be problematic. If you have a 6-inch layer of sand over the top of a silty soil, it's water is just not going to flow very well through that. It's going to go through the sand and sit, and then also plant roots are going to have a problem going into that new layer. So we have an extension publication called Reclaiming Flooded Land with Tillage, and it has a table in it that talks about how many inches of sand and what the underlying soil type is. So let's say you got a foot of sand on top of a clayey soil. You might have to mix that in a few feet to try to get to back to the point where you would have a soil that like it used to be. So I worked on that table with an engineer, and physically creating mixing down that deep, it's not something that a farmer is going to be able to do themselves. They'll probably have to hire construction equipment to try to get that level of mixing at that depth.
I was just going to say, how does a farmer manage that, Deanne? And I imagine maybe it takes a few seasons to get the land back to where it needs to be.
And I would say it may never be like it once was either, but just wow. to get it back to productivity, to where something will grow and live its entire life cycle and produce grain, yeah, it could take a few seasons, and it's going to be awfully soft, too. You do that kind of deep mixing, it's going to be rather soft and susceptible to compaction.
Huh. Is there a cover crop you can plant to help the soil recover?
That's a great idea, and that's actually, there's government programs, so the USDA has programs called for prevented plant that'll allow farmers to plant cover crops on cropland, and that's a great first start, because the other thing about soils is once they are affected like this, they're going to be really erodible. So you can imagine wind erosion that might happen after these soils eventually dry out. There could be some wind erosion. So cover crops could be a nice stab at trying to reclaim the soil. They're definitely for the soil. They'll get soil to sort of replenish itself, but it's not exactly a Band-Aid either. It's not going to definitely fix it, but it can be part of the equation to help out.
Richard, to what extent can the federal government, maybe even the state government, can they help with this?
Yeah, we know that there's help available, but we don't really know what that's going to be yet, because we know that they will help pay the cost of cleanup, but they have to be out and look at the land and see what it is that needs to be cleaned up. And in our area, nobody's been able to go out and look yet. But we know we have that. We also know that Congress approved and the president signed a disaster bill, but there hasn't been any details out about what that disaster bill is going to entail.
I'm sorry, Richard. Why can't inspectors get out and take a look at what you're up against? Because, I mean, you can get out there. Why can't they get out there?
Well, they have to drive out there and drive down the roads mm-hmm. and look. And I think the rules are that they don't go out in flowing water or washed out roads. They have to be able to drive to the area and get out and walk on it. And so far we can't do that. And that's another issue with FEMA is FEMA won't come out and look at an area until they can drive up to the area and get out and physically inspect it. And when the governor of Missouri declared disaster, he declared disaster in April when all the flooding began in central Missouri, but our flooding here began in March. So when we have FEMA inspectors look at the land and then or at the homes and the damaged personal property, why they say, okay, when did this disaster occur? And of course here we answer the question honestly, well, it began when the levee broke in mid-March, and they say, well, I'm sorry, but you don't qualify because
wow.
The disaster date begins in April. USDA, on the other hand, looks at disaster, even if our area here, Atchison County, wasn't declared by the governor to be a disaster. We are right next to Fremont County, Iowa, which was. And so the way USDA looks at it, if you're next to a county where there's been disaster declared, then you too qualify.
So, Deanne Presley, what we're looking at here is, we're using the word disaster a lot in this conversation, but that's truly what we're dealing with here when it comes to the farmers of eastern Kansas and western and northwestern Missouri.
Yes, it's definitely, this is probably the worst case I've heard of, but I would say disaster is an applicable term. This is a natural process, but when with the levees, you know, trying to control the flooding and the water, and then when it concentrates and then breaks at a certain place, then yeah, it becomes an unnatural thing. And so this is really a disaster. 1,500 acres on one farm is, for this many months, is really bad. This is a really incredible flood.
Wow. Wow. And the state of the roads where you are, Richard, how would you describe them right now?
Well, Highway 136, which is the main thoroughfare east-west highway that has a river crossing at Brownville, Nebraska, it's washed out in at least three places, and the shoulders are severely eroded, pretty much the full length of it where it travels across the valley. So it's been uncrossable now mm-hmm. Since the levees broke, it was closed, and there's going to have to be a great deal of repairs done on it. And our rural roads, this is worse than 2011 from what I've seen. Mm-hmm. We have a lot more roads simply washed away. I mean, I'm talking about gravel surfaced rural roads that serve the kind of road that serves most farms and most rural areas. And this is flat ground, and yet there'll be stretches of that road washed out 4 to 6 feet deep.
You know, Richard, I got 30 seconds left here. How much more of this can you take? I mean, these catastrophic events that you've experienced time and time again?
Well, financially, it's hard to say. There will be a lot of people, I think, look at their situation financially and say, I can't afford to do this again because I would be worse than broke. So I think the finances determine a lot, and I think the resilience of the individual who's affected, their ability to overcome the downside and look toward brighter days and a recovery from all this and better prices and raising crops again. I think it's just one of those things that you just have to wait and see what happens.
Well, Richard, we wish you all the best. You're a great spokesman for what you have been forced to endure here, and I sure appreciate your time. Richard Oswald, a fifth-generation farmer from Atchison County in Missouri. Richard, all the best to you, and thanks again for your time today.
Thank you very much. I do appreciate it.
We were also joined by Deanne Presley from the Department of Agronomy over at K-State. Deanne, thank you very much.
Thanks. I enjoyed it very much.
Well, David Koch passed away on Friday. Tomorrow we'll take a look at how his family's Wichita-based business became the second largest privately owned company in the country with the author of a terrific new book. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.